What do you think a no-limit person would do if they arrived at a party and they found out that everybody had dressed formally and they had dressed casually? He wouldn't even notice. He's not focused, or she's not focused, on external appearances. Not focused on what other people are wearing, or how they look, or how I look. They simply understand that dressing is just something that you do, and you do it based upon what you feel like wearing. Now, this is not to say that this person is going to show up at a formal affair with tennis shoes and a loincloth. In other words, that would be a person who is still trying to impress other people with their uniqueness and their differences. And the fact that you have to impress other people, it means that other people's impressions are what are controlling you. No limit people have controls from within. Always controls from within. That's the important concept here. Control from within. So that they dress based not upon what other people are going to say or think or feel or do or how other people are attired. They dress based upon what seems to make sense for them. And when they arrive someplace, they don't say, oh, my God, you've got jeans on and I don't, or you wore this and I, oh, I've got to go home and change so that I can be just like everybody else. They don't notice. Somebody else has to point that out to them. And that's very different than some of the stuff you'll hear some people in the profession talking about how important it is to be concerned about everything that you wear, and you've got to wear the right handkerchief, and you have to wear this, and what you wear is really important. I've never concerned myself with that. It's never been an issue for me. And I've never found that it's been anything that's had much of an effect in my life. I mean, if I do show up someplace and everybody else is dressed different, nobody cares, and it doesn't make any, and I enjoy my meal just as much, or the whatever it may be, and that's just the end of it. It's the concept of not noticing that's really crucial in this whole area of living at the highest level. What we have to do to understand this business of self-love or self-acceptance is to get at this notion that purpose in life and what you're here for and what you're doing is something that finds you. It isn't something that you find. You get yourself unclogged, you get the junk out of you. You get the hatred, the anger, the fear, the all of the kinds of thoughts that are put-downs of the self, self-contemptible kinds of thoughts, self-rejecting thoughts. All right, you get rid of those, and you get centered. Robert Frost said, we all sit around in a ring and suppose, while the secret sits in the center and knows. The secret that sits in the center and knows is what the centering process is about. It's what no-limit living is about. It can't be the force that operates in your life if it's clogged up with something else. All right? I think of it like a container. And if you have a container that's full of manure, there's no room in the container for love or for anything else that goes into it. And we all have manure in our lives, okay? But it's knowing what to do with the manure that's really important, all right? I mean, everybody has that in their life. But if you take the manure and put it into the ground and use it for fertilizer, you can grow beautiful flowers with it, all right? So it isn't whether you have manure in you, it's knowing what to do with it and where to put it so that you can create flowers or bread or whatever it is that you want to create. The centering process is really commensurate with self-love and self-acceptance. And the centering process is more than just a metaphysical term. It is a total acceptance of where I am and who I am and where everyone else is, and a non-judgmental, balanced approach, a physical balance and a mental balancing of everything, and an acceptance without judging. It's like seeing the world as it is, not as I would like it to be, and no negativity attached to it. That when you get to that, when you're able to think that way, then the all-consuming notion of, am I valuable, am I worthwhile, that's a real low-level place for people to be. When you're questioning your value, you're questioning your worth, your whole esteem as a human being, when you question that, when you even ask the question, am I valuable or am I important, you're operating at a real low level. When you're always focused on, I've got to prove my value, on the basis of getting you to like me. That's another low level, all right? Or I've got to prove my value or esteem as a human being based upon being successful, that is, achieving a whole lot of things. You see, everything in the universe, it comes in paradox. Because we are in paradox, because the planet is in paradox. I mean, think about it. The paradox that you are is that you are form and non-form at the same time. You are your body, and yet you're not your body at the very same time. You are your thoughts, which you can't get a hold of, and yet you're your body, and so you always have these two conflicting kind of things. Well, our planet is like that. I mean, our planet is like a magnet. If you think of a magnet, it's got a plus on one side and a negative on the other side. It is a whole that is a combination of opposites. All right? It's always a combination of opposites. Everything in life that has any significance comes in paradox. And it's like that magnet. I mean, how can one thing be two opposites and still be one thing? How can a human being be someone who wants love and wants to get it, chases love and never gets it? And the person who doesn't care about whether they get love and just is love has love come into their life all the time. The person who wants the most approval in life and goes after it and demands it based upon something that is lacking inside of them never gets approval. They don't get the approval. But the person who doesn't care about approval, I mean, think of the person who gets the most approval in your life. And that's somebody who doesn't even care about it. Why does someone who doesn't care about approval get approval, and someone who tries to get approval never gets approval? Because someone who wants to get approval is doing a disapproving thing. I mean, who wants to be around people who always want to be approved of? It's an irony. It's a paradox. And most people's reason for having self-doubt is that they start from a premise that I call lacking, that something is lacking. When you do the whole psychology of motivation, you find that most people are motivated based upon what Maslow called deficiency motivation. That is, they start from the premise that something is wrong, something is missing in me, and my motivation is going to be to repair the deficiency. I'm not strong enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not happy enough. I have something lacking, all right? No limit people aren't motivated by deficiency. They're motivated by growth, all right? Where I am is where I've chosen to be. There's nothing wrong with what I've chosen to be. I can still grow. If you look at a flower that is alive and you look at a flower that is dead, you say, what's the difference between the two? One is growing, one isn't. If you look at a human being that is alive and another one that one is growing and one isn't. Growth and life are the same thing. Growth motivation means I don't start from the premise that anything that I've ever been up until now is anything other than what I had chosen up until then and what I knew how to do. It's not lacking, it's not deficient, but I can go in this direction. But I'm always going from the premise that where I am at this moment is fine. That's what self-love is. Where I'm going at this moment is fine. Where I'm going at this moment is fine. And where I will get to and where I am now are equally okay, are all right. That's what self-love is. You are not going to get it all. You are it all. You are not going to arrive at happiness. Happiness is the way. You're not going to be a healthy, happy, successful person if you do all of these things that are missing in your life now. Because if you cannot appreciate everything that you have right now in your life, I mean really appreciate everything that you are and have right now, you don't need another thing. What do you need something else for? You'll just be in a new position to not appreciate something else. Your limitation is an inability to accept and love where you are right now. When you get that you have to be able to take every moment of your life and see it as complete and whole and total, then all you have to do is see that in the next step you'll be there too. And on the things that you think you really want are going to start arriving in your life. The irony, the paradox again, the less you chase them and the more you're just focused on being centered and the secret in the center that knows, the self-love that is there, what you have to do will be very clear, and what you need for yourself in your life will arrive in your life in amounts sufficient to take care of all your needs.
The key to a positive self-image, it seems to me, is self-confidence. And self-confidence is something that doesn't happen to you. A lot of people get confidence all mixed up. They say things like this to themselves: I want to be a dancer, I want to be a writer, I want to be an actor, I want to, whatever it may be, I want to be an executive. And they say, I want to dance, I just want to get out there and I want to be a dancer. I said, well, why don't you go out there and dance. You know, get out there and do it a lot. And audition for every show that comes along and dance, you know, take lessons from all of the top dancers. No, I don't have any confidence. As soon as my confidence is increased, then I'm going to be a great dancer. They get it all mixed up. You see, the only way you get confidence to be a great anything is by first going out and doing it, and doing it, and doing it again and again and again. And after a while, you begin to... Confidence comes from behavior. Confidence comes from risk-taking, from not worrying about failing, from not being so consumed about whether somebody else is going to laugh at you, not being afraid to fall down. The difference between a neurotic and a no-limit person are both of them are climbing a hill together, you see. And there's a big patch of ice that neither one of them expected, and they both fall down. The neurotic stays there, whines, complains, says there's not supposed to be ice in April. They promised us this on our itinerary. There'd be no ice. It's not fair. Look at, I cut my new clothes. That's not right, you see. And they complain about it. Whereas the no-limit person just gets up and kind of dusts himself off and says, watch out for the ice, you know, and keeps right on moving. They allow failures to be something that mobilize them. Whereas people without self-esteem or self-confidence allow failures to immobilize them. They go out and they try something and they're not successful at it. They're 12 years old. And they walk in and they say, I would like to be principal of this school, or I would like to be the president of the National Bank of Detroit, you know. Well, we don't need any 12-year-old presidents. See, I told you I couldn't be anything. That's the kind of attitude that they have. Whereas the fully functioning person goes, well, if I can't be president here, maybe I could sweep floors in a bank in Toledo or whatever, and uses their rejections and their failures to go on and try other things. The essence, it seems to me, of achieving self-confidence is doing. I hear, I forget. I see, I remember. I do, and I understand. And not one moment before. If you don't have self-esteem, if you don't have self-confidence in yourself, get up off of your rear end and do anything that will make you feel a little bit better about yourself, and then do it again, and do it again, and before long, you'll be a person who has confidence. I said, I remember the very first time that I had to give a book report in school, what I felt like the night before, knowing the kind of friends I had who were pointing to you like your fly was open and all of the other things that they do. And how frightened I was and saying, please, please, maybe the teacher will have a stroke, you know, and she'll lose her memory and won't remember there's a Wayne Dyer in the class. Anything, hoping for anything, so I didn't have to get up there. And I said, how do you get to a point where you can walk out in front of thousands of people and talk? It didn't just happen. That was a frightful experience. You do it once, you do it again, and before long, it becomes something that is easy and fun and exciting for you. And the other part of that self-confidence is that you don't equate your image of yourself as a human being with how well you do things in life. You are not what you do. If you are what you do, then when you don't, you aren't, right? You don't exist. If you are your business, if you are how much money you make, if you are your home, if you are your family, if you are your children, if that's what you are and those things go away, and they always do, they always do. Life is very transitory. If you lose your job, and you will, somebody as long there's going to come along and take it from you. That's the nature of the way it works. If that means your self-image is tied up with that, then when your job goes, when that promotion doesn't come, when the house goes, when the children leave, when your spouse dies, whatever it may be, then you die a little bit too. But if you are what you believe you are, and if you allow yourself to fail at some things and do well at other things and to take risks and so on, and you don't confuse your worth as a human being with what you do in life, you see what you do in life as choices, but you never, ever compromise on this one choice. You are always a valuable, worthwhile human being. Not because anybody else says so. Not because you're successful. Not because you make a lot of money. But because you decide to believe it and for no other reason. If you don't understand that, you won't have a handle on being a no-limit person.
If you weren't allowed to be a child when you were a child, what I suggest that you do with that is you understand that even as a child, you take over very young. And you don't blame your parents, especially if you're an adult now. You don't blame your parents for what you could or couldn't do or what you're able or not able to do in life. I was a teacher for many years, and I know that you cannot teach English literature to someone who doesn't want to learn it. You cannot teach algebra to someone who doesn't want to learn it, who refuses to. And you cannot take away a person's childhood, unless we're talking about just absolute outright physical abuse, which is a different subject altogether. When we're talking about human beings who lived in a family situation in which their parents, they feel, as children, especially over the age of 4 and 5, kept them from doing all of these kinds of things, that you have to take responsibility for how you reacted to your parents. And this is what I used to always tell my clients. You didn't know how to deal effectively with your father. You didn't know how to get what you felt you were entitled to from your mother or from your grandparents or whatever. Yes, but they were bigger, and I was like, yes, I understand all of that. Yes, you were small and they were large and they set the rules and all that. But you still didn't know how to get what it is that you want. And in families, where there's 3, 4, and 5 children, you'll find that some children in the family are able to figure out how to have a happy childhood, even in a situation which other people would construe as negative. And others are just beaten down by it and feel that somebody else controlled them or did this to them. So that I think it's important to even go back through your whole life and take responsibility for how you reacted. Everything after the age of 4 and 5, I think children take over very early. Now, this is not to say that the influence of a parent isn't significant and can't have a significant effect on a child. But it doesn't do you any good to look back with blame. What you have to do is look back with responsibility, responding with ability. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. Now, this is a very important concept, all right? And people would be in my office and they'd say, well, my mother would never let us roll down a hill and she would never let us get dirty. And one lady said, my mother would never let me ride a bicycle. And I say, well, okay, there's a hill over there and there's dirt over there and there's bicycles over here and there's swimming pools over here. And you can virtually have anything that you wanted. And they would say, well, I didn't come here and pay you the kind of money I'm paying you to teach me how to ride a bicycle. I said, well, if you understand that the only reason you don't know how to ride a bicycle is because you've never gotten on one and actually gone through the trial and error that goes with learning anything, and if you stopped blaming your mother for the fact that you couldn't stand up to her throughout your life and just go ahead and do it anyway. I mean, if my mother or father or anybody, a stepfather that I had, would have told me that you can't ride a bicycle, there's no possibility that I would have paid very much attention to that. Yet you did, for some reason. That's where you were, where I was able to get on a bicycle and make it happen. So you take responsibility for it, always. Then you don't have to spend endless hours in therapy and going through deep analysis to figure out why you were toilet trained harshly or why your mother liked your sister better or any of those kinds of things that you hear people using as excuses for why they're not where they want to be in their life. We take over early. What I would always do as a professional counselor and training professional counselors and therapists was to teach the children, even teach young people, that if they've got parents who behave in ways that they find intolerable, don't blame the parents for the way that you're feeling in your life. It isn't doing you any good to just toss out a lot of blame and say, oh, they're old-fashioned, or they have a lot of rules that they impose on me, or they're abusive towards me, or they don't know what it's like in this generation. Figure out how to be effective within the constraints of the relationship that you are in right now. How can you get the things that you would like to have for yourself in your life and still not always be in conflict and not always be upset and always be blaming somebody else? Your parents are the way they are. When a kid would come into me and say, I'm having trouble with my science class, my science teacher, he just doesn't like me, I'd say, what is your goal in science? And hardly ever is a child's goal in science to learn science. Their goal is to get through science and not have to repeat it and to move on. And if they learn some science, that's nice, all right? So I would say to them, you're getting thrown out of science class. Your science teacher is mad at you. You're mad at your science teacher. you're not reaching any of your goals. And it looks to me like you're going to have to repeat science again the way that you're going. Why not focus on the solution? Why not focus on what am I doing here? What do I want out of this experience? And then instead of wishing my science teacher were different, and as adults we all do the same thing, you know, we forget what our goals are.
If I stood up here and were to cut my hand, and then you were to look at my hand and just watch it, you would see that in a very short time, the wound would close up. If it stayed open, what would happen is that the disease process would set in, there would be sepsis or disease, there would be infection, and if I continued to keep it open by just pushing it open, making sure that it didn't close, I would eventually die. The organism couldn't live, because the natural tendency of a wound is for it to close up and heal. Now, when we get into the spiritual dimension and the psychological dimension, what happens is that we get wounds from our childhood and from our past. We were only children, we were abused, we were abandoned, we had in-laws that were a certain way, or parents that were a certain way, we had alcoholics for parents, we had to be put into orphanages, we were around drug addiction, we were poor, we were rich, whatever it is, we have all of this stuff in our past, and what happens is that we bond to it. And we use these wounds of our past for attention. We use these wounds of our past for pity, and very often we lead with these wounds. So that when I introduce myself, it isn't very long before someone knows that I'm the child of an alcoholic, or that I was an alcoholic myself, or that I was abandoned, or I was abused, or whatever. And we keep hauling out these wounds. And one of the reasons we don't heal in our lives and we don't manifest in our lives is because we are attached to these things in our past. Rather than saying, whatever it is that happened to me, whatever lesson I had to learn from it, I got it. I've got the lesson. And now that I have the lesson, I no longer want to be attached to it and have that venom continue to pour through me and keep me from healing. So I let go of that. And most people whose lives are not filled with the things that they would like to see manifested for themselves are experiencing this. Because they're back there hanging on. How can you possibly talk to me when this is what happened to me when I was a child? How can you possibly say these things to me when don't you know what I've been through? You hear this, and if you don't do it with yourself, you do it with others. And if you don't do it with others, you do it with yourself. It's backwards and forwards all the time. And it comes from this sort of hallucination that we have that says, I and everybody else is entitled to a perfect pain-free childhood. And the fact is that whatever you needed to go through in your life, in order to get the lessons of why you're here, you went through them. And all of those things, as you look back on them, you can either take them and say, they taught me how to be stronger, or you can say, poor me, and lead with them and keep opening that wound.
And one of the greatest things that you can learn in your life is the understanding that as you go through your life, even the people who love you the most are not going to approve of you half of the time. Somebody says, you're a nerd. Terrible thing. I mean, one of the things you have a choice. You say, oh my God, they know. They've discovered it already. And you act like a neurotic. You have that choice. You have other choices as well. The choice to ignore that, the choice to say that's somebody else's opinion. If somebody says to me, Wayne Dyer, I don't like your books. Well, I expect that when you say something in public, when you talk to a lot of people, when you write something, that there are going to be a lot of people who aren't going to like what you say. One of the highest levels, one of the highest places you can get to in your life is a place called being independent of the good opinion of other people. Not necessarily needing everyone to approve of you all of the time. And we ought to have a lot of people out there who understand that, so that when they go through their lives and they run into disapproval, that instead of becoming depressed about that, that you understand that that's a condition, that's what it means to be a human being. I'm saying, don't become immobilized
ever by what anybody else thinks of you. And when you do, understand that all you are doing is saying your opinion of me is more important than my own opinion of myself. Every time you're down. Every time you're down. That you are making other people's opinions of you more important. Now, a great misinterpretation there is that somehow this is a selfish philosophy. Believe me, there's nothing selfish in that. One of the simplest learnings that all children seem to understand, the very simple understanding that you can't give away what you don't have. You can't give away what you don't have, obviously. You can't give away 100 hours if you don't have it. You can't give away love for others if you don't have it for yourself. You can't give away success if you don't have it for yourself. You can't love another human being at all if you don't love yourself first and think of yourself as a worthy person. So that if you want to be a great altruist, a philanthropist, somebody who loves everybody in the world, then you've got to get your own house in order. And that's all I'm saying. Get your own house in order, your own self in order, so that you can become one of those people that have transcended, who have gone beyond simply worrying about how they're going to cope with their lives.
On our planet, you can't give away what you don't have. And if you don't have love for yourself, then you can't be loving to others. You can't give something away that you don't have. So self-love is the name of the game as far as being a no-limit human being. And it has nothing to do with conceit. And a lot of people confuse that. They assume that if you love yourself, then you're conceited. Conceit is another form of approval seeking. If I have to tell you how great I am in order for me to feel good about myself, then your opinion of me is what is controlling me. And that's just approval seeking. It's like giving up control of myself in order for you to like me. But if you have what I call a quiet love affair with yourself, the self-actualizing or no-limit person, which is the person we're talking about here, if you ask the question, do you love yourself, would probably respond, I never thought about it. It's not anything I give any attention to. Or, of course I do. It's what I am. I mean, why wouldn't I love what I am? Because self-love is already a given. The no-limit person is so busy being, so focused on purpose and what they're about and what they're here for, that they don't have time to notice what their neighbors are doing or what anybody else is saying about them. They don't even have time to notice it. I have a very, very strong belief that everyone that comes into our life, everyone, from the stranger sitting next to us on the bus, to the person driving next to us on the freeway, to our children, our husbands and wives and parents and all of that, they all come to us as teachers. And that the key to being effective and awakening in our lives is to be students rather than teachers. To see them all as someone who has something to teach us. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. You begin to look at it that way. You take away some of your supercilious attitudes and your holier-than-thou, better-than-somebody-else, elitist kind of thinking, and you begin to look at, what does this person have to teach me? In all my traveling all over the world, if I'm in Istanbul and I meet a beggar standing there with one arm and one leg, I know that that person has something to teach me, that they're in my life for something, whether it's, and I can learn something from that person. And it may just be to be a little more generous and to give a little more, or it may be to just give a smile or to be loving or whatever, but there's a lesson there for us. Imagine in some parts of the world, like in India, There are places in India where children are taught that they can put out fire with their minds. And they train their minds, and they work on their minds, and they go inward, and they meditate regularly. There are places in the world where holy men can be buried for 6 and 7 days at a time, and put in, and they can literally bring their heart rate down to zero and step out of it and survive. I mean, we think that that's not possible, that our minds aren't capable of that. We have to rid ourselves of all skepticism about what can be achieved for ourselves. And the way that you do that is through a wonderful old Zen proverb that most of us have never really looked at in depth. And the proverb is, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Now, it doesn't mix with what you have been taught about doubt and fear. You've been taught to doubt that things will appear for you just because you have a readiness. But let's look at the four key words in this concept. The first is the word student. See, you've got to stay a student in life. You've got to understand that that you have to have a willingness to allow yourself to learn anything or unlearn anything at any time. A student is someone who decides not to be an expert, who is always, instead of responding with, oh, I already know that, oh, you can't tell me anything new about that. Oh, I've lived a long time, and you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And all of these kinds of statements and belief systems and knowings, which are doubts and fears of discovering something new, you create a new mindset, if you will. And a new mindset is, gee, that's interesting. I've never heard of that before. Yeah, I never heard it quite put that way. I'd like to examine that. I'd like to see if that might have some validity for me. So what we want to do is to make a commitment to ourselves to stay a student. Now, a student is someone who learns from everyone. A student isn't just someone who goes to class and takes notes and passes an exam and gets a scratching on a transcript someplace. A student is someone who sees the fullness of God in everyone and everything. And when you do that, even the person who is behaving in a way that you think is nasty, you see that fullness of God in them, and you begin to say, what has this person got to teach me? What is this anger that is coming out of them? What can I do with that? How can I use this and perhaps help them with it? How can I serve a little bit better? You become a student. You do it with your children. I'm the first one to admit that I slip, and it doesn't always work for me, and there are many times when I forget, and then afterwards I sort of rehash it and say, oh, I should have done it this way, or if only I would have done it that way. But it's like it's that wonderful reminder to stay a student. And if you keep that attitude, it will help you to unlearn some of the things that tell you that, well, if I'm bigger than somebody else, like I'm an adult and you're a child, then I'm a complete person and you're not. Well, children are not apprentice people. You know, they're whole, they're complete, they're total. And if you're a parent, you know that they have something to teach you from the moment of their conception. Because the birth of a child or the conception of a child is such a wonderful gift, such a phenomenal miracle, that it every time, and when we've had 8 of them, every single time that my wife has gone through the experience of childbirth and feeling that soul growing within her, we are just in awe of the miraculousness of this. And we don't treat that little, especially when the baby is born. I mean, the first moment, my wife always, you know, she'd take the little baby and say, oh, we're so glad that you're here. You have so much to teach us. We're so glad that you're with us, you know. And we feel that way about them all the time. Keep in mind that you're in a constant state of change in your life. You're continuously learning how not to behave and what new talents and intellectual skills and personality variables to use. The old ones no longer work. That's what you have to remind yourself. Instead of saying, I've always done things that way and I'm just an aggressive person by nature, now you can say, now I know better. Obviously, when your sister used to hit you when you were 6 years old, or you used to hit her when you were angry at her, or vice versa, now you know better. When you get mad at your sister now and you're an adult, you don't go over and hit her. You know better. You've learned something new. And the same thing is applicable to everything. You don't have to say, I don't have the talent to do something. just like I know better than to say I'm just inferior, I'll never learn how to walk. I guess I'll just have to crawl for the rest of my life. You didn't say that then. Today you know better. And even for me to say that I couldn't write a book about manifesting miracles, at one time I believed that. Now I know better. Getting that notion in you that now I know better, four key words, is an indication that you're trusting that invisible intelligence that's within you to go beyond that which you've accepted as just your fate in life. And you're beginning to say, hey, I can raise my IQ, I can raise my talent level, I can change around the things that I've always believed about what my family did to me in my life. Your family came to you in exactly the same perfect way that everything else came to you. I mean, you don't look at your liver and say, I wish I'd have gotten a different liver. Or you don't look at your tonsils and say that the wrong tonsils or that the wrong eyeballs, everything that you got was in divine order. Your family is just as much a part of that. And you had something to learn from them. And you don't question any of that. And if there's things that happened in that family that you wish wouldn't have happened, you can get on with forgetting about wishing that something wouldn't have happened, forgive, and move past it, but celebrate it and understand it. Stop seeking out opinions on your personality and who you are as a human being. Asking nothing of anyone in the way of assessment, forgetting about looking to IQ tests to determine your abilities. Look instead to your own divine awareness of your unlimited abilities. Forget about what other people are saying regarding your talent or your fitness for anything, and consult your own inner personal advisor. Other people may give you this realistic assessment of your abilities and be the critics. There are two things about you. There's your reputation, and then there's your character. And there's nothing you can do about your reputation. If you go out into the world and you give a talk or you write a book or you do anything in the world, you're going to have hundreds of reputations. If I give a talk to 1,000 people, I have 1,000 reputations. I can't do a thing about that because my reputation is not located within me. It's located in how other people choose to process me. That's what a reputation is. But I can be responsible for my character. I can be responsible for how I choose to assess who I am. And that's something that I only have to answer to with myself, with God, with my own personal members of my family or whatever, or whomever I choose. And it is nothing to do with what other people think of me or how other people choose to process me. So by not looking outside of yourself for the opinions on what you can do, what you can accomplish, how far you can go, how smart you are, how talented you are, without having to go to other people, you now are looking inward and asking yourself and reminding yourself that I am divine, I am in perfect order, I am a part of this universe, that divine intelligence flows through me. There are no accidents in this universe. And because there are no accidents, my personality is just exactly what it's supposed to be. It's only what I've chosen for it to be. And if what I have chosen in the past isn't what I want it to be, then I'm going to manifest that which I do. And all that I manifest in the physical world comes from how I process it inwardly.
The greatest cause of stress in our world is being in an unresolved relationship. Not a divorce, not a marriage, not the change of jobs, not losing a job, not losing someone close to you. It is living on a daily basis in a relationship which you know is unresolved. I don't know if I'm going to be there, if this is where I should be, if I shouldn't be, I don't know. Thinking about it, I'm hoping that he'll change, I'm waiting, I've been waiting 28 years, he still hasn't changed, maybe things will get better, and so on. Living like that, whether it's 28 years or 28 hours, resolving, living in unconflicted love means I can look out into the world and the people that I love, whether it's one or 200 or whoever I come across, whether it's every child and every animal and certainly many, many people, and unconditionally, in an unconflicted way, say, I can love you. Because, and my definition is that you don't have to meet my expectations, and I don't want to be told to meet yours. And if you can just pass that test, you're in unconflicted love. If you're not, resolve it. Resolve it. Whether it's getting it back together and making it work on a daily basis, or getting the hell out of it, you will be in a better position either way. Unconflicted love. And finally, these people who share the secrets of the universe, who seem to understand what I've been talking about, they are what we call growth motivated rather than deficiency motivated. Most of us are motivated by our deficiencies. I want to improve myself, so there I'll do this. This is improvement. You don't have to be sick to get better. You don't have to look at yourself as in bad shape in order to grow. Everything in the universe is exactly as it should be. If you stop judging it, including yourself, and go to work and resolving the things that you don't like and accepting those you can do nothing about, and literally run your life on where I am is just fine, and this is where I'm going, and each day is just fine. That's called growth motivation. Because the cosmic erroneous zone, the biggest one, the big, big one, the one that hardly anybody can resolve, because they're always caught up in those qualities I talked about earlier, like size and authority and acquisitions and achievement and rules. The biggie. You resolve this one, you got your life in order. Ladies and gentlemen, there is absolutely no way to happiness. Happiness is the way.
Question of whose advice to follow and what other people's opinions mean in life boils down to understanding that other people's opinions are just that. And that's very important. Another person's opinion is not truth. At least it's not your truth. It's not necessarily reality. It's not necessarily the best. It's not necessarily anything. It is somebody else's opinion. Opinions are of very little value. It's only your commitments. It's what you do with your opinions that makes all the difference in the world, not what your opinion is about something. And so what I have learned to do with other people's opinions is, first of all, to see them as their opinions, which means that they can't hurt me, they can't destroy me, they can't make me into anything less than I am as a human being. They simply are other people's opinions. Now, I've established for myself that my reputation is a meaningless concept. Everybody's reputation is a meaningless concept. Because if you go out, whoever you are, whether you're a businessman, whether you're a student, whether you're a parent, or all of those things, and you go out into the world and you do something, let's say I go out in front of 1,000 people and I speak, there are 1,000 opinions that are all unique and different from each other, and I don't know what any of them are. And that's what constitutes my reputation. My reputation is located in other people's opinions. That's what a reputation is. So I don't care about my reputation. I'm not interested in it at all because I have no control over it, none whatsoever. What other people think of me is where they are. Whatever I do, however, whatever level I'm doing, if I'm in Carnegie Hall or if I'm just with a friend of mine in a business, what other people think of me is just that. Terry Cole Whitaker wrote a book called, a great title, one of the greatest titles of any book I've ever heard. Her title of her book was, "What You Think of Me is None of My Business." It's none of my business. So my reputation, since it's located in other people exclusively, is something that I have no control over. I mean, I go out and give a talk. I've given talks many times. I've been on The Tonight Show many times, and I will get letters, and I will be telling a joke. And it will be just a joke. It'll be just a funny little remark. And I will get 50 letters. And one of the letters will say, "That was a funny joke. That was really terrific. You were sensational." All right, so you got to put that. That's an imposter. You have to put that imposter over here. And somebody else says, "How dare you make a joke like that? That's not a funny thing to say at all." That's another imposter. You put that over here. And someone else will say, "I didn't think what you said was appropriate. It was in bad taste." And you put that one over there. And you understand that all of those things are your reputation. And they're all different. And none of them have anything to do with me. I was telling a joke. I don't know where you are. So I've learned not to be concerned with my reputation, but instead to be concerned with my character. And that I'm in charge of. All right? I'm always in charge of that. I can never be in charge of how other people are going to perceive me, because that's their opinion, and they're all entitled to it. I mean, on the very same day, about a month ago, I got two letters on Pulling Your Own Strings. And one of the letters said that it was the greatest book that he had ever written. It had changed his life completely, and he had given me all of this credit for the transformation that had taken place in his life as a result of reading Pulling Your Own Strings, which I had written many, many years before. The very same day, in the same mail, was a letter from somebody who told me that he wanted a refund. He said, "It's so bad that I insist that you or your publisher send me back the refund for the book." All right? And what I did with the letters is I sent the real nice one to the guy who had written me the bad one, and I sent the bad one, I just had him Xerox, and sent it to the guy who had written the good one and said, "These are both imposters." And I wrote the great line that H.L. Mencken always used to write to anybody who wrote him letters. He always just said, "You may be right." Not, "I am right, I'm right and you're wrong," or whatever. "You may be right," and I just signed my name and sent them off to them. I mean, it just shows you how silly it is to go around being consumed by what other people think. What other people think is just that. Now, supposing you take somebody else's advice and you mess up, all right, and it doesn't work for you. The no-limit person is someone who understands that everything you do in life, you did because you were supposed to do it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done it. And the evidence is that you did it. All right. So the evidence for that you're supposed to do things is that you did it. You can't not do it. You can't should have done anything, or if only. If only doesn't exist. So you did it. Now you have a couple of choices to make about taking somebody else's advice. First of all, you understand that it wasn't their advice. If I have a stockbroker and he gives me advice to buy this stock and it goes down, it wasn't his advice that made me buy the stock. It was my own advice. It was I took his opinion and I internalized it and I said to myself, "I would like to make some fast money on buying this stock and I would like the stock to go up, and he says that it will, but I'm believing it. I'm buying it. It's mine. And I am then saying I will buy it." I can't blame him if the stock goes down. I can say to myself, "All right, I'm going to get a different stockbroker." But I take responsibility for the losses that I've encountered. Now, you treat the loss as an opportunity. I mean, everything that happens to you that is considered negative or that is considered a failure or a loss is a hidden opportunity. And the seeds for all solutions to all problems are in the problem itself. The cure is in the illness. The cure is always in the illness. Otherwise, you don't need a cure. If there's no illness, do you need a cure? Of course not. I mean, there's no sickness there. So that a cold has within it the opportunity to transcend a cold. Being an alcoholic has within the alcoholism the seeds for transcending something about yourself that was controlling you before. So that reformed alcoholics, the first thing they do is they celebrate their alcoholism. "It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It made me face something in myself." You ought to be the most grateful to the people that you feel are causing you the most upset in your life, because they're the ones who force you to face yourself. And it isn't what you face that controls your life. What you face in life, you just move on and deal with it, and you're in charge of it. It's what you don't face that controls your life. The overweight person who just simply ignores and won't face my compulsive eating, the alcoholic who won't face the fact that I'm drinking too much and I'm in control, the people in a relationship who won't face the trauma between them. You see, if you can't say no within a relationship, you'll have to say no to the relationship eventually. By saying no within the relationship, any relationship, what I mean is that you have to let other people know, including the people that love you the most, your parents, your children, your husband, your wife, your affiliates, your business people, your friends, you have to let them know that you have to be your own person. And that when they want you to be something that you can't be because it conflicts with where you are on the path, and your own path of enlightenment, of fulfillment, of no-limit living, that you have to say no to that. And that will strengthen the relationship. You will let somebody know, these are the limits. This, no, I can't be that. I can't be your little victim. I can't just be your little servant. No, I can't be the kind of person that you can tell me when I have to be here or what I have to think or what time I have to be there. No, in other words, you're saying no, the N-word, okay? It's a big word to be able to say. And you can do that with love and dignity and respect, but firmness. But mean it, all right, with commitment. Not with your opinion is controlling me, but with this commitment that, no, I have to say no to these things that you want of me because I can't be what you think I should be. Then you'll never have to say no to the relationship because it will flourish and grow. It's only what you don't face. It's only the things that you just continue to ignore and you hope will go away that are really controlling your life in a negative way. So it's just like you reverse all of that. You begin to stand up to the people that you love the most and also the people that don't even know you. The strangers. The same thing applies in just a simple little exchange of a bank teller or a sales clerk or whatever. If you can say no within that relationship, no, I won't be treated this way, but I think you're terrific. You're having a great, you know, but I won't be talked to this way or I'm going to get my refund or whatever it is that you can say no within, then you don't have to say no to the relationship. You don't have to just walk away in a huff and get mad and lose, but you have to be able to do it with an inner conviction, with the love that you are. Not with love, but with the love that you are. You have gotten yourself to the point that you understand that what's inside of you is a result of what you think. You have unclogged yourself of negativity and processing your world in those ways. So that when you encounter a situation in which people are having a different opinion than you, that what you do with that is you respond with what you have inside. And when you respond with what you have inside, it's firm. It's no, but it's always love. And then you don't have to blame anybody for anything that happens in your life.